Thank you very much, Ty. First, I want to thank Henry and Ty for the invitation. As he noted, I'm a homeboy. I don't like travel too much, but every once in a while, I actually get out of my office. I thought it was kind of interesting that the last talk was on entropy, and so I'm not really quite sure whether I'm getting more complex, and so that's a good thing, and entropy is going down, or if I'm really just really going toward chaos, and I guess we'll know more by the time we're done. I want to thank also my co-authors, Yakov Pacheski, I think most of you know, and Andre Guber, you know, both of ARS, Lynn McKee and Randy Rowland are also from ARS, Tom Nicholson and Ralph Keddie from Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I put a dot, dot, dot here because according to the laws of entropy, if I already knew what I was doing to begin with, I might have actually put more people on the list, and some of the data I'm going to be showing you actually I probably should have. Greg McCarty from ARS and also John Pruger and Jerry Hatfield should probably have done this as well since I'm using some of the data I've come up with them. I've really enjoyed the talk today, especially Dr. McNamara's talk, because you know, he did with catchments. We're going to essentially look at field-scale behaviors. But you know, in the real world, we have just a lot of things taking place. And there's connectivity between all these processes. But when we actually try to go and measure these basic processes and we start to account for soil properties and characteristics, there's a tremendous amount of variability. For a lot of soil properties, coefficients of variation between 25 to 50% are very common. And for some of the hydraulic characteristics, having coefficients of variation of over 100% are really quite common and generally the rule of thumb. And so one of the things we need to be asking ourselves, besides the extreme amount of variability and interaction of these processes, are there any features that we can actually quantify, and do those features actually control anything? And so a few basic questions might be, if these soil landscape features exist that govern field scale chemical behavior, how are they to be identified and at what scale? And then secondly, since uncertainty can be high, do these features influence more than one process? And by that I'm talking plant growth processes or runoff volatilization, subsurface flow, those kinds of things. So let's look at the scale issue first. Yakov put this together for me. And generally, we have these four scales that we're looking at. And we've actually seen with Dr. McNamara's talk and essentially catchment or watershed. And then we have also heard a little bit on soil core. And if we look at the number of publications over time, we see this kind of distribution where we have a large number of papers regulated to the smaller scale, and actually the scale that we have the least is the hill slope and the field scale. And yet, I think one thing is driving that is as the scale increases, we know that our ability to control the processes and actually try to understand the system decreases. Yet, there has to be some kind of optimization here where we actually look at, well, how much control can we have to actually try and understand the processes, which actually have relevance. So, if we go down from the catchment scale, that's a really cool thing, but many times, depending upon the size of the catchment, you have variability in land use and various interactions. You also have variability in climatic inputs. So even though it has a lot of heterogeneity, which you're quite interested in, the fact is you have these other interactions that you have to deal with. At the other end, you have basic processes, which you maybe can have an idea of, and you can blow it up to the plot scale. But it's very difficult to understand how you actually integrate that up. So I'm proposing, and I think several here might actually agree with this, that we need to be looking at kind of the field scale, because you still have the heterogeneity and isotropic behavior, non-isotropic behavior processes. And you also have the ability to look at multiple years, look at climatic conditions, how that changes. And depending on what you're looking at, you have either concentration or flux measurements to work from. You're also looking at a scale that you have kind of variability that real farmers have to deal with, and you're also maybe using equipment that they use that have the same time, the same speeds, and the same equipment. So there's a lot of relevance to what might be taking place there. So the way we're dealing with this is, and I'm not going to go through all the data, this is just a little bit of some of the selected data that we actually collect on the site. The site actually is a government site, so it has to have an acronym. And so that's the first thing you always have to do. And the acronym that my colleagues came up with was OPE3, which stands for Optimizing Production Inputs for Economic and Environmental Enhancement. So that's a nice little acronym. Most of you are aware of this site already. But what happens, it's the actual crop production area here is about 22 hectares. It contains four fields that are heavily instrumented. And what happens is we're actually, one of the main objectives of this, the project, is to actually try to develop methodologies for actually looking at fluxes at a field scale. And we're talking about fluxes through the atmosphere. So we have eddy covariance systems that actually look at gaseous emissions of pesticides and carbon. Recently, we've actually started looking at nitrous oxides and ammonia. And so what I did is I put the eddy covariance system here. This is 100 meters around it. And of course, that's just kind of like an average major sphere of influence. Obviously, the wind directions can come from various places. And so sometimes, of course, you may actually have a plume. It's out this direction. If it's from the north or from the south, from down here, or, you know, from the east. And so what happens over time, it kind of averages over this area. And so when we're talking about volatilization data, which I'm going to show you some and how that links up with these subsurface features, this is the area that we're actually looking at. Now, and then in addition, we're going to look at these subsurface features and how it influences crop growth production as well as nutrient management. And so I want you to pay attention to the shape of this field because you're going to see it later on, as well as this guy down here, which is our precision ag site, where we actually use information on the subsurface hydrology to actually be more efficient on our nutrient management. So some of the first, since we've handled kind of the scale issue for this talk, one of the things we're talking about, well, how about these features? Are there features out there that actually influence other things? And how are we to identify those? And one of the things that we're trying to do is, besides like everybody else having a lot of soil cores, we're trying to use remote sensing and geophysical tools, hydrogeophysical tools to do that. And at the site, we have several different ground-based remote sensing activities, but we also have towers and trucks and aircraft and satellites. So we have quite a few platforms. And all of that's linked up. You may have seen in one of the earlier slides that I have these little green dots all over the place. Those are soil moisture monitoring, because we all know that soil moisture is one of the major driving forces for water, for chemical behavior and plant growth. And so we actually take over 18 million soil moisture observations every year. So we're trying to understand that dynamics is going to help us understand the kind of processes and the variability we see. But in addition to that, if we're going to try and look at some of these features, these structures, we decided to first off with ground penetrating radar. And for those of you who haven't seen that before, that's what they're doing here. They're dragging this thing across the field. And what will happen is, I thought it's just always nice to put an image in so people know what it looks like. We have a very sandy site. So what happens is you have a really good reflector for the, because you're looking at changes in dielectrics. And so what happens is this blue line essentially marks where the subsurface lens is at this location where the graph was. And what happens is you can then have your field flagged, and whenever they pull this thing across the field, they click it, and that's what you see up here, these little click marks. So you can actually put in a raster file and then do some geostatistics on it and come up with a nice little plot like this, which essentially tells you the depth to these restricting layers, which could influence things. But again, it's orthogonal to the soil surface. Now, you know, I've never fallen off a roof, and I haven't fallen off a ladder yet. But gravity, I have found recently, can be a killer. About a month ago, my wife decided for my 60th birthday to throw me off an airplane. And so I got to experience just how important gravity is. Well, gravity is also very important for a lot of things we're talking about here as well. Because after you have this, if you actually have some good DEMs, you can actually subtract your subsurface GPR data from your surface topography maps and get something like this, which would be the grayscale, and apply flow routines to it to get an idea of where the flow pathways are. So what this neural network is essentially the drainage from the site, subsurface drainage off the site. Now, we could actually talk a little bit about GPR and some of the issues associated with that and the uncertainty about that, and you'd probably be right. there's a fair amount of uncertainty in some of those things. However, you can either say, well, have I essentially tortured the numbers and they're telling me what I want to hear? Or is it actually generating something that's actually of use? And so one way to do that is, does it relate to anything else that we actually see in the field? So one of the things I wanted to do is, let's actually look at that data, and now let's tilt it sideways, because it's got a third dimension. Now, a couple times in our talks today, we've talked about these restricting layers and how nice and linear they are. Unfortunately, they're not linear on my site. And what happens is we actually have essentially a lot of variability. It undulates as it goes down toward our first order creek. And what happens is they form these little depressions or pools. And what happens is water can fill up those pools. And then if it gets high enough, it'll actually go over the lip. And then it'll go down to the next place in the pool. So we actually have two types of flow processes. We have a lateral component that's taking place that can affect chemical behavior and plant growth processes, which I'm going to show you in a few minutes, as well as a capillary action. So real quick, like, if you're in a dry year, this guy here, in location A, is going to get water and nutrients from the subsurface, like a subsurface irrigation system. Whereas plants that are in this level, like location B, either the subsurface flow pathway is too deep, or there's no flow pathway there, so the subsurface doesn't have any impact on it. So it's important to kind of have those concepts in mind. Well, with that, we say, now we've got some GPR data as far as where they are spatially and what they look like as far as their third dimension. Do these things actually affect anything? And do they affect more than one? So what I thought I'd do is take you through three things here. One is some water content, plant growth, and yield stuff. Then surface processes, like pesticide volatilization, believe it or not. That's always a fun one. And then chemical transit times. Now, you might really want to focus on chemical transport, but I thought if I was going to try and keep you awake, I'd make you listen to the other two first. So that's what we're going to do. Anyway, water contents. This is Field B. Remember what I was talking about. Field B is also the site where we actually have split application of N. They have the same crop, they have the same tillage, and the same inputs and that kind of stuff. But fields A, B, and D differ as far as their management is concerned with regard to nitrogen. And that's really the only difference that they have. So on this split application N field, what happens, I'm showing you here is a color infrared image. And so that obviously, as you all know, the bright red spots are high biomass. And that image was actually taken about July. And then what happens is, we go and we have GPS, and so we go out there and we get yield information. We process that, and these polygons you see here, grayscale polygons, actually show you essentially the yields in the system. The black polygon here is actually the average. So anything in between these black polygons is less than the average, and everything inside the black polygons is higher than the average. And what happens is it's either, you know, one and a half, two, or, you know, whatever, times greater than the average yield. And I want you to note that here's that location A. And you can see A is actually repeated several places throughout the field. And same thing with location B. And we can actually prove that with the GPR data as well. So that's actually pretty cool. I thought I would throw in the subsurface flow pathways. I only have the primary and secondary, tertiary aren't there, because otherwise the whole field's pretty much covered. And what I wanted to show you is that in the early spring, before we got to the drought conditions for this particular year, the subsurface flow pathways were actually active. And because we have this 18 million so moisture observations, here's just three sensors. There's actually seven there, but I'm only showing the bottom three. Here's 1.8 that's actually in the clay lens, and the GPR says, if you believe the numbers you get out of it, that the clay lens was located about 1.54 meters below the soil surface, and the pink line here is 1.5. This blue line right here is actually 1.2. If you were to blow that up, you would see that water is actually gained to 1.5 before it gets to 1.2, has higher water contents, it lasts for a longer period of time, has a nice decay curve, and yet the textures at 1.2 and 1.5 are the same. And so what we're actually seeing here is some evidence of this lateral flow that's actually taking place in these subsurface flow pathways. So that's kind of cool. Then what happens with it? Well, even though we have these undulating subsurface flow pathways, we know that as you, at least in theory, that if you get closer to these things, you might also be closer to these wet spots. So does that have any impact on yield? That's kind of a difficult thing to quantify. So what I decided to do is to go into the GIS and actually isolate field areas of the field relative to the flow pathways to see if there's any difference that I get farther and farther away from the flow pathways. So what we did, here we've identified areas which are very close to the flow pathways, 0 to 5 meters. And then you can see the shade area here, which is 5 to 10, and then 10 to 15. And why I'm interested here then to say, well, now I've got a lot of data out here. It's heavily instrumented. If I look at the data and how it changes between these three buffer zones, do I see anything that actually takes place? And the two things we'll look at very quickly, since we're still talking about water content is just that. These are water content measurements from using a capacitance method that's measured that's centered at 10 centimeters and has about a 10 centimeter radius. So we're looking essentially at a volume between 5 and 15 centimeters. And what happens is each color is a different, is each of the three zones for three different years. And we have essentially an average rainfall in 98. This was a fair drought, but then Hurricane Floyd came through and we had a very sudden change in water content. And then here was essentially optimum year. And if you look pretty closely at the data, you can actually see what you might expect is that as you get closer to the GPR flow pathways, regardless of climatic conditions, you have wetter soil moisture conditions. Well, that manifests itself, obviously, in how you might see plant growth. Now, here I've gone in the field and gone to a place that represents A in our schematic. And in the same field, about 10 meters away, looking a different direction toward an area that is classified as B, you get this kind of crop growth and behavior. Now, this is all vegetation. We can see it's nice and vigorous and green, very happy. And then over here, it's all wilted and stunted. And so that's a vegetative issue. And what happens is if you now go and harvest the corn and see what happens for a dry year, you get this kind of nice linear relationship. And these little standard deviations, those are actually standard errors of the mean. And there's a nice significant difference between yields as you get closer and closer to these flow pathways. So you have an impact of soil water content by these subsurface features as well as affecting plant growth processes. That's pretty intuitive, but it's nice to actually see data that actually supports that. Then what happens, we thought, well, let's say we're going to try to use this data for management. So let's go look at these two areas again and say, well, during a drought year, we've already talked about how this would be beneficial, and if you looked at the yields and normalized them over the field site, you'd find out that these areas during a dry year that are being subsurface fed have higher yields relative to the norm because they have the subsurface irrigation system. Whereas these guys here are well-drained and soil moisture is a limiting factor, and as a consequence of that, their growth and development and corn production are actually retarded relative to the norm. Now, if you kind of switch the climatic condition around, say now you have a wet year, what happens? Well, the water table rises, and now you've limited the rooting depth of the location of A, whereas in location B, water is no longer a limiting issue. It has plenty of water, and so what happens, B's got very high yields, well-drained, doesn't have any problem with the subsurface, whereas location A has got this limited root zone. And so now its root growth and development and corn production are actually retarded relative to the norm. Well, what that allows you to do then, if you normalize for these wet and dry years, and then you take the normalized yield for each pixel, however you want to do it geostatistically, typically we're about 8 by 8 meters in the graph I'm going to show you in a few seconds, or it might be 10 by 10, I've actually forgotten. But anyway, what happens is you just take the normalized yields for a dry year minus the wet year, and if you do that, that allows you to show that the areas that are in this area here have large numbers, whereas this area here would have a negative number. It's very simple, and it's kind of nice because it's hard to identify these flow pathways where it'll have impact on an economic basis because GPR is pretty expensive and time-consuming. So this allows farmers to use yield data or remote sensing tools to actually quantify it. So all that disappears, and magically, this actually approaches, and you can see, is that my glasses or not in focus? Anyway, is it okay? Okay, so what happens is the dark green is those areas which are dominated by the subsurface flow using that same kind of philosophy, whereas as you get lighter areas, where's my mouse? It is not influenced by the subsurface. And then what happens, you can say, okay, now I'm going to use that information, the location of that, to help me understand where I'm going to put on nitrogen. Obviously, the areas which are heavily dominated by subsurface flow, I don't need to put any nitrogen because it's going to get nitrogen from somewhere else. And those areas that aren't being fed by the subsurface, it's not going to get that, so I'm going to need to apply some. Well, what we've done is we've actually done that in Field D. Field D is our precision ag. And what happens is Field B, which is a split application, so we're putting sometimes 120 to 150 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. And you can see that for the first few years here, the yields are essentially the same. And then what happens is weather conditions actually improved a little bit, and the yields went up. But as you look for these, essentially from 2001 on, there's really no difference. Generally, they're pretty close to each other. Once in a while, the site that uses precision ag has higher yields. But for the most part, statistically, there's no difference between them. And yet, we put 30 to 40% less nitrogen on the site because we're just essentially being efficient in where it's being used, and we're using the subsurface hydrology to help us understand where to put the nitrogen. And of course, that has an issue if you're interested in global climate change and some issues that are linked up to that. So anyway, so we say again that the subsurface features are having a positive impact on how to effectively manage the site. Then the last one, is volatilization. Again, the nice thing about this is, you know, what field scale processes are actually controlling pesticide or herbicide, in this case, herbicide loss to the atmosphere. And it's, we have this eddy covariance system, which allows us to calculate turbulent fluxes. So we're going to handle both stable and unstable atmospheric conditions. And what happens is we want to see the impact of soil moisture, because we've heard, at least in theory, that as water content increases, the soil particles will have an affinity for absorbing the soil particles, and the pesticide might be a little farther away. If energy comes to the system, what happens? And so we decided to actually put systems up to actually represent these two areas, starting in 2004, to get an idea if there's any difference between these. Because if one side's drier and the other side is wet, we have the same textures. You have pretty much everything that's the same, with the exception of usually site A has a little bit higher organic matter content, which is also easily understood. We might actually see some interesting results. Well, the first thing is, now we're looking at water contents that are very shallow. These are about 3 centimeters. And we can see, again, as you would expect, higher water contents. You can also see it wets up at night, little diurnal water coming back up. But this is what's really interesting, is that the pesticide fluxes, they're actually coming off the wet spots, are twice as high as they are for the dry spots. That's really cool. That is just really cool. And we see that consistently, unless the system is completely dry. In 2006, where's my cursor? Right here. You can see both lines are essentially on top of each other, and that's because there's no difference between the water contents, because we were so dry, the subsurface system wasn't active, and there wasn't sufficient water for capillary action. And so the water contents were the same, and as a consequence, the fluxes were also the same coming off the sites. So that's really cool, but having this kind of information also allows you to look at the basic mechanics. Those things are actually influencing pesticide behavior. And this is also kind of cool. If you look at, this is pesticide volatilization, surface cell temperature, and time after application. The solid line here is the actual temperature. Dot line is the actual fluxes. These are both for the same year. This is the wet location, dry location. And what happens, you'll see that the peak concentration to the day are linked for the high temperatures in the afternoon. When you're dry, though, that doesn't happen. In fact, the peak concentrations actually come at sunrise. When the sun comes up, because of dew formation, then you got the pesticide going off. And you see this all the time. And so what that means is that just because the temperature is increasing doesn't mean you see an increase in volatility. You first have to have soil moisture there. Then after soil moisture is there, then you see the linkage in temperature that increases pesticide volatilization. So there's some very basic stuff. But again, it's all related to these features, which are the subsurface hydraulic conductivities. Now, what you probably really want to hear is before I retire and sit down, are the chemical transit times. On this site in Field B, we have an area by these dark blue areas where we have some sprinkler irrigation system set up. We apply tracers in the center one here, and then we irrigate every day. And we irrigate every day for several months. And then at the same time, So we put tracer there, it's in the irrigation system, and then we just keep on irrigating it. And then we have these series of wells which are down gradient. The first set of wells are 5 through 9, and the second one are 10 through 12. And I'm just going to show you the well data from these first five here. But you'll also notice that if you're along this edge, you're kind of in that A area that we're talking about so far. Whereas over here, you're close to the field, you're talking about B. And of course, I'm going to show you some data specifically from well 5 and 7, of course, which is a bit closer. And then actually 8 and 9 down here. And so we had hoped that as we apply the chemicals, and if you actually believe in some of the standard equations which are available to us in our present modeling systems, that you'd have this nice radial transport of compounds that go out into the environment. Unfortunately, that's not what we see. Here's 5, 7, and 9, 5, 7, and 8, I'm sorry. And what happens is you see the early, one of the breakthrough curves you can actually take out here. It takes about 2 months for it to get to that well 7. And this is a little farther away, and actually goes to well 5. And if you're trying to model those classically, we actually have to use model abstraction techniques and actually include a little preferential flow, because you can't describe the shape of the curve, the peak, and the tail without doing that. But one of the problems, and as a consequence, it still takes several months for the compounds to get to those points. But what we don't know is what is going on with this well 9. Because you see it goes up pretty quick, and then it has a sudden drops, and it goes up, and then drops, goes up. And it turns out that every time it drops, there's been a good rain event for this year. And so if you go back to this kind of perspective, and you say you put the tracers here, and forget the AB thing, but just relative to the subsurface and the surface, and then you actually hit a flow pathway, it's moving down here. You have to remember that when it rains, of course, a lot of water that doesn't have any tracer, it's going to come in the system and dilute the system. So you're going to have a very dramatic reduction. But the places where you don't have this, you're not going to see that change, which we didn't see that. Only in wells 8 and 9 did we see this kind of behavior. And then what happens is as this compound gets farther and farther out, there's tertiary flow pathways, which take a longer time period to actually get to the flow pathway. And so you can't get a bimodal distribution. And so to actually see if that's the case, I need to put another tracer on, but this time, instead of using chloride, which is pretty much everywhere, actually use fluorobenzoic acid, which is rather unique to our site, obviously. And we did that, and we didn't get a lot of rain this time. So what happens is, instead of taking several months, it takes a few days for it to get there. Kind of some point of perspective that as you start to approach those A areas, you have essentially hydrologically active areas where your transit times are dramatically reduced. And there's been a lot of work by many of you here, as well as like Sam Kung, who's not here today, that have shown that once the system is hydrologically active, your transit times are dramatically reduced from days to minutes. And we see the same kind of thing here, except we're not just talking about vertical. Here we're talking about vertical and horizontal transport. So it kind of links up with that very first figure where I showed, where you had those hypothetical subsurface layers, and then you had that interception and lateral transport. So since uncertainty can be high, do these features influence more than one process? And I think I've showed you a number of things where yield and volatilization and water contents, pesticide transport times are all influenced, but they're influenced heavily by these subsurface features which we're actually picking up. So inclusion, I'm probably ending a little early, but this is good. You always hate to go long if you're going to take a break. You don't want to interfere with that. So the subsurface features do influence the hydrology, so that's very critical. And I think also the use of hydrogeophysical tools and remote sensing will be very critical as we try to extend information up from the point to field and watershed scales. Though I think, this is my personal opinion, I think those are still kind of their infancy. I think there's a lot of work to be done in that. And also, as you can tell from the list, we actually have several different geophysical tools. I think that's also the case. I think we're going to have different types of geophysical tools as well as the standard destructive sampling we do to try and support the things our actual field observations. I've also shown that the subsurface flow pathways, they're not linear, at least on our side, And it really depends on the climatic interactions. If you have a dry or wet spring or however the precipitation comes, it's going to influence how that behaves. On our site, because we understand it so well, we can actually predict yield distributions throughout the entire field and do a very good job of it, because we actually understand the soil water content, so it's changing and where it's happening and why. And so we can actually predict yields spatially, not just the averages, but where the high yields are going to be and where they're low in the field, and do a good job of that. We also talked about how the capillary action is very important, and how even compounds which are considered non-volatile by certain groups, and based on low Henry law constants and vapor pressures, actually are quite volatile. And as the last thing I want to show here is that when active, these surface flow pathways can have a dramatic impact on reducing transit times, even laterally. So we see a lot of connectivity, and so I think some of the things I said here linked up with Dr. McNamara's talk kind of linked together. They're a slightly different scale, but pretty much the same kind of message. And so I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk to you, and now open for questions. And hopefully nobody has any.
That's a great set of bookend invited talks. That I think really set the session really, really well. If anybody has any public questions, please.
Yeah, so can you identify a special water type or state and say, okay,
initiates that flow? We have not, but we would suspect that each of the pathways will be different because they have different geographies. Some are very narrow and deep, and some are quite wide when you actually look at the GPR data. And so I think they probably have a slightly different response. So we haven't done that, but I would think that it wouldn't be uniform on the side. Now, if you were to take that, some of these flow pathways actually converge later on. So it may be if you went farther down, closer to the riparian area, you might actually be able to see that, because I didn't mention this, but if you take those hypothetical flow pathways, which I always call them that because I'm aware of the uncertainty in your calculation, they actually lead right to the upwelling zones of riparian area, which then feed this little creek that we have out there. And so there might be some optimal point that you could measure that you might actually get a good relationship, but I don't know where that point is, and we haven't done it.